This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The World Health Organization is trying to fill the gap left in the COVAX dose-sharing program by India, suspending exports of AstraZeneca doses and in talks with donors, including the United States. Bruce Aylward, WHO senior advisor, said there was no firm date for resumption of Indian vaccine exports amid its COVID-19 crisis. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus told the same briefing that the global COVAX program needs $35 billion to $45 billion to vaccinate adults next year against the COVID-19. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is expected to authorize Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for kids ages 12 to 15 by next week, setting up shots for many before the beginning of the school year. That's according to a federal official and a person familiar with the process. The FDA action would be followed by a meeting of Federal Vaccine Advisory Committee to discuss whether to recommend the shot for 12 to 15-year-olds. Then the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention would act on the committee's recommendation. Those steps could be completed in a matter of days. Air travel in the U.S. hit the highest mark since COVID-19 took hold more than 13 months ago. While European Union officials are proposing to ease restrictions on visitors to the continent as the vaccine sends new cases and deaths tumbling in more affluent countries, the improving picture in many places contrasts with the worsening disaster in India. In the U.S., the average number of new cases per day fell below 50,000 for the first time since October, and nearly 1.67 million people were screened at U.S. airport checkpoints on Sunday. This is VOA News. The U.S. and U.K. dismissed reports once again out of Iran that they are handing out a prisoner exchange deal with Tehran that could see the imminent release of a British-Iranian woman and four Americans, among others. Iran was a key topic of discussions Monday between U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and his host in London, British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab. Their meeting took place a day before the first face-to-face meeting of foreign ministers from the Group of Seven, leading industrial nations in 2 years, largely due to the coronavirus pandemic. Iran, Ukraine, China, Russia, climate change, and COVID-19 are expected to dominate those talks. U.S. President Joe Biden is lifting the refugee cap after a backlash over delaying that move. We get more from AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
President Joe Biden will formally lift the nation's refugee cap to 62,500 this year. The decision comes after Biden came under intense criticism for delaying a decision to lift the 15,000 refugee limit instituted by President Donald Trump. In a statement, Biden said the new limit erases the historically low number set by the previous administration. However, Biden called it a sad truth that the cap of 62,500 refugees will not be met by the end of the fiscal year in September. Biden plans on setting the refugee cap at 125,000 for the 2022 fiscal year. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump continues to try to stay relevant in American politics by attempting to tighten his grip on the Republican Party, AP correspondent Tim McGuire.
Former President Trump and his backers appear to be working to purge the Republican Party of members they see as disloyal. On Monday, Trump said, despite all of the evidence to the contrary, that, quote, the fraudulent presidential election of 2020 will be from this day forth known as the big lie. Trump and his congressional followers are trying to force Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney out of the House leadership. Cheney continues to denounce the attacks on the election by Trump and his followers as poisoning our democratic system. Utah Senator Mitt Romney was booed at a meeting over the weekend by Trump backers who failed to get the state party to censure him for opposing Trump. Romney warning, quote, if we divide our party, we're going to be a losing party. Tim McGuire, Washington.
Bill and Melinda Gates say they're divorcing. The Microsoft co-founder and his wife said Monday that they would continue to work together. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the world's largest private charitable foundation. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 4, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Chad's Transitional Council announces a new government.
There is not a big change. We have just two persons from opposition. We have Vitalik Abzabu as one Ministry of Environment. We have also Alabo from Justice.
Malawi's president looks at mining as a key foreign exchange earner. Zimbabwe businesses seek herd immunity to avoid economic lockdowns. The Biden administration says it is serious about global climate change. Today is World Asthma Day. We'll look at asthma in Kenya. And a judge in Angola dismisses defamation charges against journalist Francisco Rasgado.
Basically, the judge said that Mr. Rasgado, the judge called Antonio Santana, he didn't commit any crime. He was doing his job as a journalist, reporting on corruption cases.
And we will examine nudity protests in Africa. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Transitional Military Council has appointed a new government that includes some members of the opposition. However, Inugalta Anu in the Chadian capital, N'Djamena, says the opposition is criticizing the new government as old wine in a new bottle.
There is not a big change. We have just two persons from opposition. We have Vitalik Abzabu as one Ministry of Environment. We have also Alabo from Justice. So there are just two persons in this new government.
So there is a new Ministry of Reconciliation and Dialogue. What can you tell us about this Ministry of Reconciliation and Dialogue?
Exactly. This is the new ministry, but the one who is occupied this post is one from MPS. So there is not a big change. People are not glad to see this person occupy this this function. The most changing thing that we have to take some order, someone who is not from the opposition, not from MPS, to occupy this function in order to call for the conciliation. But the one who is occupied this function is not the one who the Chadian people need him to occupy this place.
That was Inugalta Anu speaking with us from the Chadian capital, N'Djamena. Malawi's president, Lazaro Chakwera, has announced plans to reform the country's mining sector to boost the economy and crack down on rampant illegal mining and mineral smuggling. Chakwera said if properly regulated, mining could play a major role in Malawi's economy, currently one of the poorest in Africa. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi's president in a national television address late Sunday said a well-regulated mining sector has the potential to develop the country's economy. Lazarus Chakwera noted that despite a lot of mineral resources in Malawi, the sector has faced exploitation not only by foreigners but also local miners. He gave an example of uranium mining activities in the Kairekera area of northern Malawi, run by Australian-based company Paladin Africa, which he said did not yield the desired results.
Although the Kairekera sandstone uranium deposit was discovered during Malawi's first presidency in 1982, six presidencies later, our country has nothing developmental to show for it, not even in the Kairekera community itself.
Chakwera said Malawi has issued over 250 mining licenses, but has no proper mining industry or retains to speak of. Minerals found in Malawi include uranium, gold, bauxite, coal, and phosphates. The country has a proliferation of small-scale miners, most of whom are operating without a license. In 2018, Malawi police and soldiers cracked down on a gold mining site outside the capital, Lilongwe, that was attracting foreign buyers from neighboring countries. They burnt down the mining site and shacks and also arrested some illegal miners. Pese Maleta is the chairperson for Nyasa Mining Cooperative in the capital, Lilongwe. He says the minerals being mined do not generate any revenue for the country.
We have a sector which doesn't pay tax, especially with the gold rush, where we are losing a lot of land to unprofessional type of mining. When we are exporting these stones, very few stones go through the system. I wouldn't even be surprised to say it's less than 10%. Most of our stones are being taken outside Malawi through uncharted routes.
He says there is a greater need to bring sanitary into the industry so it can replace tobacco as Malawi's main source of foreign exchange. Lawmaker Welani Chilenga chairs the Natural Resources Committee in the Malawi Parliament. He told a local radio Monday that Malawi has enough laws to regulate the mining industry, but the problem is implementing them.
As a country, we have a very strong Mines and Minerals Act. Implementation is not taking place. That's the challenge which we have. If the Mines and Minerals Act was implemented, illegal mining would not have been there. We have illegal mining all over. We don't have to regularize illegal mining. It should be contained according to the law. So the challenge that we have is that government is failing to implement the existing laws which Parliament passed. That's the biggest problem.
In his speech, President Chakwera said the Minister of Mining will work with the police to curb illegal mining and smuggling activities. Lameck Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Businesses in Zimbabwe say it is only through achieving herd immunity that economic lockdowns can be avoided and have launched a private sector vaccination program. The aim is to assist government efforts in ensuring more people are protected from COVID-19 sooner. Rutendo Manwere reports from Harare.
Zimbabwe's private sector has joined the government's efforts in vaccinating the nation by purchasing vaccines for their employees and donating vaccines to government for the public. Gertrude Mashonganyika is the chairperson of the Business Preparedness, Prevention and Response to COVID-19. She says there is need for concerted effort to fight the virus.
Even if the third wave is going to hit us, the impact is not going to be as devastating. So that's why we are trying to say, let's get as many people vaccinated as possible. The business community was not just focusing on their employees, but also the communities. So for every vaccine that was given to an employee, the business communities was able to then donate through the government so that at least the communities also get vaccinated. Because it's important not just to have an island of businesses that are protected, but you also have to have the community in general vaccinated so that the economy can keep going.
Mashonganyika adds that business hopes a reduction of infections will prevent further economic lockdowns, which she says could be disastrous. This private sector vaccination plan will be spearheaded by SIMAS, a private healthcare insurer in Zimbabwe. SIMAS chairperson Emma Fundira says the many deaths and infections in the country worried business leaders.
It's a private sector-driven initiative to assist government in its mass vaccination drive, the goal of which is to halt the rapid spread of COVID-19 and achieve herd immunity by having at least 60% of the population vaccinated against the virus.
Zimbabwe Deputy Health Minister Dr. John Mangwiro admits that alone, the government will not be able to procure enough vaccines.
This initiative is welcome for a number of reasons. With government resources limited and stretched through the demands that this pandemic has put on it, a private sector initiative to meet the cost of more or some of the vaccines is very welcome. The initiative also further demonstrates the patriotism of private sector organizations that have been working together with the government to combat COVID-19 for the benefit of the nation. It demonstrates what can be achieved when we act together as a nation with unit of purpose.
Zimbabwe has partially vaccinated about 430,000 people, and more than 94,000 are fully vaccinated out of a population of about 16 million. Health experts estimate at least 60% of a population needs to have immunity from a virus, either from having contracted it or through vaccination, to achieve what is known as herd immunity. For VOA, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 4th. The Biden administration says it is serious about global climate change, demonstrating its intent with a number of expensive U.S. projects across the African continent that aim to address climate change, poverty, and economic growth. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Climate change, poverty, and economic growth. These three indicators, the U.S. leadership says, are inextricably linked in the fight against environmental degradation in the developing world. But to make change happen, they need money. Enter the Millennium Challenge Corporation, an independent U.S. agency that gives out big grants to modernize infrastructure, address policy reforms, and promote growth in sectors that affect everyone in the economy, from the youngest child to the most ambitious entrepreneur. Acting CEO Mahmoud Ba explained in a call with journalists on Monday.
These grants are large, multi-year, and predictable. These are not loans, and they do not add to the country's debt burden. Our compacts tend to pair large investments in infrastructure in sectors like water, energy, agriculture, with institutional and policy reforms that ensure those investments have a significant and sustainable impact.
What that looks like on the ground, he explained, is this. Hundreds of millions of dollars poured into developing nations, most of them African, for hydropower projects, agricultural improvements, better access to electricity, and land reform. Neither Ba nor his deputy, Alexia Latorture, explicitly mentioned China, which is rapidly rolling out development across Africa through an ambitious infrastructure project known as the Belt and Road Initiative. Latorture sought to distinguish the American way of doing business.
MPC's three strategic priorities are inclusion and gender, catalyzing the private sector, and thirdly, climate. And if there's one takeaway I have for you, is that the three priorities are all about helping to achieve high-quality growth.
And she said the U.S. has proven this commitment.
So MCC recognizes that climate change is absolutely linked to poverty and economic growth. Indeed, MCC was an early leader in fighting climate change in developing countries, investing in the past 5 years alone over $1.5 billion, which is about 38% of our program of funds in climate-related activities. Our climate work covers adaptation, climate resilience, and mitigation.
To that end, she said, the corporation has made a new goal. More than half of their funds in the next 5 years will be used for climate change work around the world. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A judge in Angola on Monday acquitted journalist Francisco Rasgado for criminal defamation brought against him by Rui Falaciao, Secretary of Information for the ruling People's Movement for the Liberation of Angola, MPLA. Falaciao had alleged that Rasgado published articles in the Chela Press and on Facebook in July and August last year, accusing Falaciao's administration of corruption. Florindo Chivukute is executive director. Director of Friends of Angola, he says the judge dismissed the charges on the grounds that Rasgado was simply doing his job as a journalist.
Basically, the judge said that Mr. Rasgado, the judge called Antonio Santana, he didn't commit any crime. He was doing his job as a journalist, reporting on corruption cases. Therefore, he couldn't be held liable for doing his job.
Why did the judge all of a sudden have a change of mind? These were serious charges against Mr. Rasgado.
I cannot read the judge's mind, but one thing I can tell you for certainty that there was a backlash from civil society, including NGOs like Friends of Angola. That wasn't acceptable that someone who was doing his job as a journalist reporting alleged corruption cases who would be held accountable and detained and accused of crime simply for doing his job. And this is something that the civil society couldn't take it. There were social media, there were a number of individuals raising questions. This also comes time when President Lourenco is cracking down on local media. For instance, there was a ruling by President Lourenco government to shut down one of the Zap channels and the Brazilian channel as well, allegedly for having the CEOs foreign of those channels. Although those local TV stations, they completely dismissed what the government has said in regard to the charges for shutting down the channels and they challenge the ruling. So it didn't really come in a vacuum. It comes in a time when there's a really cracking down on the private media, not just journalists, but also TV station channels, independent channels.
I know that the Friends of Angola, besides monitoring the freedom of information and press, you are also monitoring political developments in Angola. What's the latest now?
There's a number of things going on. One of them is the fact that there's a change in the constitution that President Lourenço has initiated all suddenly, right after the massacre in Kafunfo, a diamond-rich region in Angola, that we're still waiting for independent reports to really help us understand the scope of this issue. The Angolan government claims that there were only 5 or 3 people that were killed, if my memory serves me well, but independent reports are claiming, including parties in opposition, like UNITA, they're claiming that more than 20 people are being killed.
President Lourenço, when he came to power newly, he took on the fight against corruption under the former president. So where are we in terms of the fight against corruption in Angola?
That's a good question. I mean, so in the beginning, everyone, not just Angolans, but the international community applauded. I remember being in Washington, D.C. That's the talking point. So when you would mention Angola, everyone would point to the new policies, the reforms that President Lourenço was doing. Now, after a few years, since he became the president, so the Angolans have become more skeptical in regard to those reforms, because there is really a belief in Angola there is more, this type of fight against corruption, or so-called fight against corruption, has been selective. In other words, is going after the former president of Angola, Mr. Dos Santos, family members, in particular daughter, Isabel Dos Santos and Tize. But there is other individuals like Manuel Vicente, who's probably the richest man in Angola, who have benefited from the corruption, who are still untouchable and very close friend to President Lourenço.
It's very nice to talk with you. I appreciate it very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Florindo Kivukute is Executive Director of Friends of Angola. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Chronic respiratory diseases are among the leading causes of death worldwide, with asthma rated the most common chronic disease affecting children. According to World Health Organization, about 300 million people have asthma, and current trends suggest that an additional 100 million people may be living with asthma by 2025. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, at least 4 million Kenyans are living with asthma.
The World Health Organization estimates that about 250,000 deaths from asthma every year occur in low and middle-income countries. In Kenya, respiratory diseases are higher in urban areas than in rural areas, and the cases are growing following increased air pollution. Judy Kirumba is a 30-year-old Kenyan living with asthma. She says it has not been easy for her given the frequent attacks. And with the COVID-19 pandemic, doctors insist on treating her for COVID-19 and not the usual condition.
This COVID time has been a very challenging time for me because I have to be really careful. I had an experience where I had my chest was congested and I needed a nebulization. And it was very hard to go to the hospital because the doctors were, they were treating it like COVID. Yet I knew this is something I've been having for a long time. I know there was a time I almost died at the trying to tell them, please, I know what I need. And at this time, I was fighting for breath.
Asthma is widely known as a multifactorial respiratory disorder with both genetic and environmental underlying risk factors. Exposure to common allergens, including pollen, dust mites, and animal fur, have all been linked to triggers of the disease. Another Kenyan, Nancy Wanjiru, is asthmatic. In her family, she's not alone.
I was diagnosed with asthma, I think, in the first 5 years of my life. So meaning I've been managing asthma almost all my life. My type of asthma is acute asthma. And then having given birth and one of my children already has developed the symptoms. We're 6 and our firstborn brother and myself probably are the ones who've had a fair share of the asthmatic experience in our lives. My mom is also asthmatic. She's almost 80 years.
Asthma is the commonest chronic lung disease in the world, but in many parts of Kenya, it remains underdiagnosed. Dr. Samuel Gadhua from Kenya says most people with asthma in Kenya have got mild asthma, which is very difficult to diagnose. Hence, these people suffer the most.
Mild asthma is the commonest form of asthma. About 70% of most asthmatics will have mild asthma. A lot of them will not go to hospital. Another probably 20% may have moderate asthma, and only about maybe 10% get severe asthma. A lot of those people with asthma will have a family history of either allergy or asthma.
He says asthmatic people are diagnosed on clinical ground, and the main challenge they face is that most people do not know how to use asthma medication, especially the inhalers, which is the most form of medication offered to patients.
The other challenge that we have is availability of drugs. Asthma medications, best medications are inhalers. The challenge is in knowing how to use the inhaler. A lot of people don't know how to use it. And a lot of those who sell the drugs don't have the time to teach the patient how to use the inhaler, because when they use it wrongly, they think the medicine doesn't work.
According to the Global Initiative for Asthma, detailed history, physical examination, and spirometric lung function tests are very important for the diagnosis and management of asthma. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
For a second year, Nigeria's Muslim population, the largest in West Africa, is celebrating the holy month of Ramadan under the cloud of COVID-19. Nigeria's mosques have resumed communal prayers and daily fast breaking, which were banned last year, raising concerns among health officials. Timothy Obiesu reports from Abuja.
Since Ramadan started April 13, Isa Idris joins hundreds of Muslims who observe special evening prayers at Abuja's Nasfat Mosque daily. And once the prayer has ended, they all proceed for iftar, a large meal to break the day's fasting. Idris says he struggled during Ramadan last year because of the pandemic.
As of last year, even for food in my house, sincerely speaking, God bear me witness, I found it difficult. It was my mom that helped me. But unfortunately, this year, I get food in my house and I do my iftar here and I also do my sahur here.
Sahur and iftar are meals to mark the beginning and end of a day's fasting. Hundreds of people at the mosque benefit from free meals through Ramadan. But feasting and communal prayers were halted last year as the coronavirus restrictions held firm. Many, like Idris, who depended on such meals, struggled to get through the fasting. Muslim clergy and head of the Nasfat Mosque, Sharafuddin Abdusalam, says they found other ways to hold prayers.
So most of our lectures last year were online lectures, and people don't come to the mosque last year to observe Taraweeh. People don't come for the 5-day prayer.
But things are different this year. Nigeria is seeing a lower number of cases, and mosques across the country are once again holding regular meetings and prayers. But the World Health Organization and Nigeria's CDC are also warning of a possible rise of COVID-19 cases during Ramadan. Mosque Secretary Abimbola Okwala says they're taking steps to prevent that.
As we are entering the mosque, there is provision for you to wash your hand. We have a tap, about 4 or 5 taps, at the gates. So as you are entering, the first place that you go to, there is an arrow, and there are some security personnel that will ensure that you wash your hand.
Okwala says everyone entering the mosque must also wear a face mask in line with WHO recommendations. Charity banquets and other communal gatherings remain banned in many countries around the world because of an upsurge in cases. But with safety measures in place, Ramadan this year is easier for Nigerian Muslims like Isa Idris. Timothy Ubiezi for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And that's it for this Tuesday, May 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a good day.